This is another audio-only podcast. What I'd like to do is talk a little bit about the history of the mortgages in the United States. Mostly, this is to give you the idea that what you think of as a common mortgage, for the most part, a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage that fully amortizes, has not always been that way, and it has adapted and changes to circumstances. So in order to start you off this story, we'll start off with the way mortgages looked prior to the Great Depression. We're looking at before the 1930s. When you're looking at the 1920s, mortgages were typically very short. They weren't 30 years long. They were between 5 and 10 years. They were also variable interest rate. Essentially, every single year you renegotiated what the interest was going to be with the bank. And they were always going to be interest-only mortgages. And so what you were doing then was kind of saving up money in the bank in order to pay the bullet. Or what you were doing was basically you'd take out a 5-year mortgage, save up some money, have your real estate go up in value a little bit, and then you'd refinance the mortgage to whatever it was that you needed to in order to still keep your house. And again, this was very typical. Now, what may actually surprise you quite a bit was that the idea of borrowing 90% of the value of the house in order to buy it was extremely uncommon. And in fact, it was more typical to have a loan-to-value ratio that was closer to 50%. So if you're trying to buy yourself a $5,000 house, you had to actually save up, you know, $2,500. And this is part of the reason why we had all sorts of savings and loans, plenty of institutions. People had to put together quite a bit of cash before they actually bought themselves a house. And then after they bought it, they had to continue to save because their mortgages were interest only, and they had to continue to save because, well, they had to refinance every 5 years, and they had to maintain themselves as being a good credit risk. Now, I told you there was this event that started to change some things, and that event that did change things was the Great Depression. Now, when we had our mortgage crisis here and we had our real estate crisis here in the United States recently, there was lots of talk that this was supposed to be something that was unprecedented. Well, that's not entirely true. In fact, during the Great Depression, real estate prices fell on average 50%. Not in the worst places, but on average 50%. Now, if you think about what that means in a place where the loan-to-value ratio is commonly 50%. So if you had a house that was worth $5,000 and you owed $2,500 on it, and then suddenly it fell in value, you had to come up with a lot more cash, an extra $2,500, in order to refinance this house. So what happens was is lots of loans which were coming up on the refinance cycle, because of the fall in real estate prices, could not be financed. And so there were loads and loads and loads of foreclosures that was going on as that bubble was, you know, busy deflating itself and as all those people were defaulting on their loans. And if you remember from microeconomics, you know, you go ahead and you throw some supply out there, prices are bound to go down lower again, which caused yet more foreclosures and so on down the line. So it was this cycle that reinforced itself and made things quite a bit worse. Now, what the government response was during the 1930s was to stabilize the loans. And so what you saw first was the creation of something that was called the Homeowners Loan Corporation. And what they did was is that they raised some funds by selling some government-backed bonds. Government-backed simply means that the government, federal government, guarantees that they will be repaid. And so these bonds were sold, and then what they did was they purchased some of the mortgages that were being defaulted on from the banks. And they were commonly purchased not for their face value, but for pennies on the dollar. So maybe purchased for something like 50 cents in the dollar. And you see that this is something that was actually tried during our last cycle too, but there was a great deal of bickering on how they were supposed to price these bailouts, these repurchase up of them. Anyway, once the Homeowners Loan Corporation purchased these loans, what they did was that they changed the terms a little bit. Now remember that these were commonly short 5 to 10 year interest-only loans with variable interest rates. And what they ended up doing was they changed them to fixed-rate 20-year amortizing mortgages. And what that means is that the loans, instead of being 5 or 10, they were longer term, and the payments were such that when you made your last payment, you didn't owe the bank anything. Instead, what you did was, instead of being still owing the amount that you originally borrowed. Anyway, during the period here, they also created the Federal Housing Administration, which actually created something that was mortgage insurance. Now, mortgage insurance had existed before in the private market, but it didn't start to become large until the federal government brought it into the regular mortgage market. Now, what mortgage insurance is supposed to be is it is insurance which protects the borrower, it protects the lender should the borrower stop making payments. And essentially what it does is it allows risky loans because of the amount of money that folks are borrowing to have effectively a higher interest rate while they're still risky. And then to have the mortgage insurance fall away when it's no longer necessary because the loan isn't quite so risky. And so what it allows you to do is start off with higher interest rates for the risky stages of a mortgage and then have the interest rates fall as the mortgage becomes less risky. Now, this mortgage insurance was also important in giving some liquidity to the mortgage market again, because people were not trusting that they were going to be paid back, the banks were. And so what the insurance did is it allowed some of that risk to be pushed off from the banks onto somebody else. And so it made it so that loans actually continued to be granted to people so they could actually build and purchase homes. Now, this was eventually replaced by the Federal National Mortgage Association in 1938, and it continued that practice of selling government-backed bonds in order to fund mortgages. Now, again, this was 1938, and we got out of the Great Depression essentially because World War II started. And so lots and lots and lots and lots of people were getting back to work. There was not a lot of consumption goods production going on during the Second World War because so much of production was devoted to the war effort. So there was a little bit of a pent-up demand that was there. Also, at the end of the war, there was this fear that our economy would sink right back down into the Great Depression. And in fact, you can see it in some of the movies that were there. And there was also this additional fear that it was possible that we could have like a revolution of some sort because there were so many people that were trained in the military. One of the things they did in order to make it so that we did not fall back into the Great Depression and also to make it so that the military servicemen came back and were going to be productive was the Servicemen's Readjustment Act of 1944. And most of you know this as the GI Bill. What this did was it created Veterans Administration mortgage insurance and allowed a larger fraction of the population to actually start owning homes that it owned before. And so it was this giant expansion of the capacity to actually own your own home. And what that did is it stimulated the construction trade as a way of jump-starting the economy. So there was a lot of building that was going on. And you saw the real serious large-scale start of subdivisions. And so if you ever heard of Allentown, this is where that started up. It was at this time that Federal National Mortgage Association, something you probably know as Fannie Mae, actually liberalized the mortgage terms again. Recall that when the government first started getting involved in mortgages, they had 20-year fixed mortgages. Well, now they kind of changed the standard to a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. And the other thing that they did was they made it so that the loan-to-value ratio was closer to 90%. Again, this was really intended to stimulate the economy so that we didn't actually fall into the Great Depression again. Now, that institution of mortgage insurance, which we had seen a little bit earlier through the Federal Housing Administration, started expanding out into the private sector, and that was being used for large loans. These are ones that the Federal National Mortgage Association didn't actually handle directly, but still needed the insurance there in order to keep them nice and liquid. Now, as far as the macroeconomy goes, as far as a lot of econ stuff, one of the things that you're going to spot is the 1950s are kind of a boring era, even though lots of things happened there. And the same thing with the early 60s. When it comes to the loan story, though, things really start to heat up when you're talking about the late 1960s. So we're talking about 1966 and 1968. And here's the way the problems started to lay out. That's when we really started to get inflation would kick in as a persistent story. And at the same time, we had this giant buildup of debt that was hitting us because of both the Vietnam War and also some of the Great Society initiatives. And so what happened is that the yield on government bonds topped over 4%. Now, that may not seem like a huge thing to you, but you have to remember at the time, banks, savings and loans, all had caps on what kind of interest rates they could give on deposits of all kind. In particular, things like checking accounts weren't allowed to have interest rates on them. So 4% was something serious that you were giving up. You could either deposit your money into a bank, which was insured by the government, and get 0% interest, or you could go ahead and lend it directly to the government, which is, you know, the same government that's insuring the bank deposits, and get 4%. So what happened was that the banks were finding it rather difficult to go ahead and get deposits. And when the banks are finding it difficult to get deposits, they're not able to fund loans because that's the source of the funds. That's something that banks are supposed to do, is do that intermediation between time. So what you saw happening is that that Federal National Mortgage Association split into the Government National Mortgage Association. That's the thing that's known as Ginnie Mae. And that Federal National Mortgage Association, which was now private, and that was something which was still called Fannie Mae. And these things here are selling, you know, non-government backed bonds, but there's kind of this implicit promise. Ginnie Mae is the component that does insurance. You also see something that's called Freddie Mac in 1970, except that it's associated with savings and loans rather than banks directly. Anyway, what these things are doing is the first huge stage of securitization of mortgages. And what securitization is that you basically start off with some pile of money and you fund a bunch of mortgages. And once those mortgages are funded, the people who are have those loans start making payments. So you can see that there's a stream of income that comes in from this group of mortgages. What you're doing with securitization is you package these things all together into a security, and you cut it into parts, and you sell those individual parts. And each person has a share of this stream of revenue that comes through because people are making their payments. And occasionally you'll get these little spikes of revenue that comes in because someone's going to pay off their mortgage early. And on occasion, someone will default, and so it'll pop down a little bit. But that risk and those payments are spread over a lot of mortgages. So it's not as if you're investing in an individual mortgage, but you're investing in a large group of mortgages at the same time. So that security is a little bit safer, it's a little bit more stable than a single mortgage. Now, that's the first step. It actually starts getting a little bit strange in the 1970s. Because Regulation Q, which is one of those Depression-era regulations on banks, still has a limitation on the interest rates, but then we start getting lots and lots and lots of inflation. You got to remember that in the middle of the 1970s, I think we had inflation that hit 16%, which was absolutely outrageous. But in order to get around this, we had lots and lots and lots of mortgages actually being packaged up and sold in those securities. So they were a great deal securitized. During the 1970s was when you start seeing all sorts of innovations with adjustable rate mortgages again. You see increasing securitization of loans. And you're seeing Freddie Mac also goes and becomes privately held. That's about 1989 or so. Now, what we're looking at is a world that is post-financial meltdown. People really don't like to hold on to those bonds. Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae actually own a lot of them right now, and their prices have fallen. You've seen a great deal of the solutions out on the table. We have things which are similar to the Homeowners Loan Corporation, which sells the bonds. We have the government buying shares in Fannie and Freddie Mac in order to maintain liquidity in the mortgage markets. And you've seen new kinds of mortgage insurance coming in, certain ways of widening that pool that's there. But I want to get to, again, the main point about what the mortgage market looks like in the United States now and actually just prior to our little meltdown, is that our mortgages are commonly 30-year mortgages. They're not the 20 that we had during the Great Depression. They're not the 5 to 10 that we saw during the 1920s. We're dealing with fixed-rate mortgages, and fixed-rate mortgages, in spite of what you saw during that build-up to the bubble, are classically over 60% of the market. our mortgages are also securitized. And while this may seem like a bad thing, given some of the meltdown characteristics that you've seen, it's usually estimated that because of securitization, because of the ability to trade these loans around, that our mortgage interest rates were about a point and a half lower than they would have been elsewhere. And this is trying to draw comparisons to other countries that don't have full securitization. We also have extremely high loan-to-value ratios, higher than you will see in other countries, which allows us to buy houses with relatively little cash on hand. And we have this interesting idea that after a year, that there is no penalty for early repayment of a mortgage. And this allows us to essentially shop mortgages, to basically shop a slightly lower interest rate and use a new mortgage to pay off one that has a higher interest rate, bouncing from loan to loan to loan to loan to loan. And that's something that our institutions allow for, but you don't see in a lot of places. Now, that's just one set of institutions. It can look very different and does look very different depending on where else you look in the world. Best examples I have are Canada, our neighbor to the north, which has 75% as about the maximum loan-to-value ratio. So you do have to save a little bit more in order to buy a home in Canada than you do have to in the United States. For the most part, the interest rates are fixed, and they can be fixed for up to they're variable, but they can be fixed for up to 5 years. But what you do when you're fixing an interest rate is that you're guaranteeing the bank those interest payments, and so you are stuck with the loan for 5 years. There is some government finance mortgage insurance, and they have relatively low rates of securitization, which means that bank holds onto the loans instead of packaging them together in the bonds. And this is also going to be true to a certain extent as United Kingdom, Japan, together as a group, have a little bit lower securitization rates than we do. Another example would be something like Denmark, which has about a 60% loan-to-value ratio. And rather than allowing you to pay off your loan with that balance remaining rule that we use in the United States, they actually require you to pay the market price for the bond that your loan resides in. So it's possible for you to take out a loan, make a bunch of payments, try to get buy out the loan after 5 years, and then actually owe more than you borrowed just because the price of the bond has gone up from when it was originally issued. Nice thing about loans in Denmark is they can actually be transferred to the next borrower. And like I said, because it's embedded in those bonds commonly, Denmark is one of those places that has securitization rates that are really high as ours. And then finally, the example I want to give, which is kind of a throwback, is the Italian case. Italy basically has a 55% loan-to-value ratio, and its other institutions are commonly what you would see in the United States at about the 1920s. So remember, there are variations over time within the United States. A common pattern that you'll see is perhaps an innovation in the private sector, which then the government picks up, which then becomes dominant in that particular institution, and the government releases it again to the private sector. You will also go ahead and see a lot of variations from country to country to country. And so if you are moving around a bit and looking at purchasing some property, just remember that the rules that you're used to in the United States are not necessarily the rules elsewhere. And what you think as being common or sensible are not necessarily common or sensible for that particular area. There's a lot of solutions to every single one of these incentive problems.